Welcome to In the Moment. I'm Lori Walsh. You might have heard last week that the Federal Reserve's Open Market Committee cut its target range for the federal funds rate. And while that generates a fair amount of financial press, it can sound like a macroeconomic mystery. Fortunately for us, it's time to bring back Morning Macro with Joe Santos. Now, Morning Macro is a weekly feature where Joe Santos explores and explains the nuances of macroeconomics. You can join us for a crash course in economic literacy and follow along his weekly blog for the updates at schooled.blog.com. Joe Santos is professor of economics and Dykehouse Scholar of Money, Banking, and Regulation. He teaches at the Ness School of Management and Economics at South Dakota State University. And he's joining us today from the Janine Basinger Studio at SDSU. Welcome back, Joe. Thanks for being here.
Thank you, Lori. It's great to be back.
Missed you.
Missed you too.
All these things happen in the news and I'm like, I don't know what that means, as well as I would know what it means if Joe Santos was here with Morning Macro. So it's nice to have
sweet.
You back on the air.
Thank you.
Let's start with why an announcement like this gets so much attention in the first place.
Sure. So as you said in your opener, the announcement was about the Fed funds rate, which is actually a market rate that banks charge one another for overnight reserves. I always think of reserves like inventory. And so banks lend reserves. Banks also store reserves in case depositors come in and want their money back. And so this management process of reserves is one that banks do sort of as a collective. They lend and borrow reserves to and from one another. They determine the rate at which they'll lend and borrow, and that's the Fed funds rate. But the Fed uses that interbank rate as a policy tool. And so, long story short, the Fed can manipulate the amount of reserves that these banks are, shall we say, fighting over at any given moment in such a way as to get the rate to be what the Fed wants the rate to be. So it's a little bit like saying, I can't set the price of apples, but I can change the supply of apples so that the price becomes whatever I want it to be. So this announcement last Wednesday was that the Fed would indeed lower its target, and they hit their targets, so this is meaningful, lower their target to something between 1.5 and 1.75%. And so that wasn't too much of a surprise. Most folks had been sort of pricing that in already. But of course, as soon as we hear this, the next question is always, okay, what will they do the next time they meet? Will they continue to lower? Will they keep it where it is? Will they raise it? And so on.
So how much of that inventory is going back and forth on a daily basis? Is it huge amounts of money moving back and forth, or is it more stable, or how fluid is it?
It's very fluid. In terms of the quantity of it, it's enormous today. If you had asked that fantastic question, say, in 2007, the world before the financial crisis, I may have given you a number like 20 or 30 billion with a B. Today, that number after the financial crisis is something on the order of 1 to 2-ish trillion with a T. So the Fed has, if you'll forgive the metaphor, flooded the market with liquidity and provided these reserves so that banks essentially don't need to fight so vigorously for the reserves. And so that keeps interest rates in that relatively low range, right? That 1.5 to 1.75 is really low, historically speaking.
So who's making the money off the interest rates, though? Who pockets that? Who pays it?
Sure. Well, the interest rate environment is low on sort of both sides of the Fed's balance sheet right now. So the Fed, you know, borrows from Peter and, or forgive me, banks borrow from Peter and lend to Paul. So the rate at which they borrow from us as depositors, let's say, is kept low because of all of this liquidity in the market. But likewise, banks are actually quite competitive. There, for example, in the United States, there are thousands of them. And so through competition, rates stay relatively low on the lending side as well. So we are, generally speaking, in a low interest rate environment. The way that banks, if there is money to be made, will make that money is on what we call the spread, the difference between what they pay Peter for his deposits and what they lend to Paul in the form of a mortgage or a car loan or what have you. That difference is where any earnings are generated. But the actual level of rates really just provides a more accommodating environment for the economy overall so that the economy doesn't stall. And that's really what the Fed is concerned about, is where certain, we'll talk about them, I suspect, a little bit, but where certain statistics, output and inflation and so forth, are relative to where the Fed reasons those numbers should be. And it's really that that's driving the Fed's interest rate policy. Yeah.
All right, so let's go there, because we hear the news and we have a vague idea of what it means, but what does it really reflect as far as monetary policy and what the Fed is thinking about the economy?
Sure. So what we're observing on any day when the Fed funds rate is being manipulated and so forth by the Fed, that's what we would think of as a tactic of monetary policy. It's operational. It's day-to-day. But it's informed by goals. And so the goals really are informed by a mandate from Congress to the Fed in the form of an amendment to the Federal Reserve Act in 1977 that says your goals will be to maintain full employment, or essentially keep the economy's output at full capacity, and maintain low and stable inflation. So there's really no ambiguity here. The goals that drive the day-to-day tactical behavior of the Fed are to keep output at its potential, at, you know, the best it could be, and to keep inflation low and stable. So this brings up this idea of gaps. And so what the Fed is really doing is, if you will, minding the gaps. They're looking at where output is relative to where they reason it could be on its best day, and where inflation is relative to where it should be based on its mandate of about 2% inflation. And so right now, and I do this on the blog, and folks can take a look at the graphs, you'll see the output gap by most reasonable estimates is positive. So output's actually a little higher than where we suspect the economy would be operating in the long run at trend. That would be a case for keeping rates relatively high. Likewise, the inflation gap is negative. In other words, inflation is below 2%. And that would be an argument for keeping rates relatively low. So there are mixed signals coming from the gaps. On the output side, it seems maybe the Fed should be a little more, shall we say, contractionary. On the inflation side, a little more expansionary. And so they're trying to negotiate those two goals on a day-to-day basis by manipulating that Fed funds rate.
Right. And listeners can log on to schooled.blog.com. You're going to spell out the word dot in school.blog. And look at some of those graphs. And you can, one of the things you notice right away is, what the heck happened in the 80s?
Right.
Take me back to the 80s and explain that to me.
Right. So that's an example of where tactics deviated from goals, shall
okay,
we say.
Yeah.
So the goal was, strictly speaking, at least as of 1977, one of the goals was price stability. But of course, what you're picking up on is what we call the great inflation. And there's really nothing so great about it, except that the inflation rate for U.S. standards skyrocketed. And so we would think in that case, monetary policy was the phrase we use is too loose, that as high as interest rates were, they throughout much of the 70s and very early 80s were not high enough. They weren't sufficiently high to rein in inflation. But if you take a look at that chart, you'll see those twin peaks of inflation rates very high. And then you notice the current situation, which is one where the inflation rate has largely hovered around or below even 2% since about the year, 1997, 1998. So that's sort of the current dilemma, ironically, is that inflation is not as high as the Fed would like it. But you're right, in the 1970s, no such problem. The inflation was certainly high enough for anyone's tastes.
All right, so let's talk about minding these gaps and how some of those decisions are made. Tell us about John Taylor.
Yeah, so John Taylor is a Stanford economist, John Taylor, who did a lot of work in dynamic macroeconomics and monetary policy, and in the early 90s proposed what became very quickly known as a Taylor rule. And now we use the term generically as any very simple algorithm, really. The derivation, I should say, is not simple, but the algorithm itself is very simple, and it just links the gaps to the Fed funds target. So I write one out on the blog where it simply says, the output gap should be weighted, say, 50%, and the inflation gap should be weighted 50%. And based on that, the little algorithm will give you a target range. And what's so interesting about this is, despite its simplicity, and again, viewers can see this on the blog, or viewers of the blog, despite its simplicity, the Taylor rule actually does a fairly nice job of tracking what the Federal Reserve has actually done. And to the extent it doesn't do a very nice job of it, in the past anyway, we haven't had very positive monetary outcomes. So, for example, the inflation that you described in the 1970s, that's a classic example of where monetary policy deviated from the so-called Taylor rule. Now, the Fed has its own arguments for what really happened. But the point is, the rule has become, well, just that, sort of a benchmark, a way we gauge policy. And long story short, what's interesting about this is, right now, if you take a look at any reasonably specified Taylor rule, and I offer up two on the blog, you'll notice that while the rule's targets map the actual Fed funds rate very well since about 1995 or so until about 2015, after 2015, that is now, we see that these rules suggest that rates should be higher, quite a bit higher than they actually are. So Taylor rule is sort of part of a larger body of work on monetary theory, but it's something we've come to use as at least a benchmark way to try to evaluate monetary policy. And the punchline is, at the moment, for most reasonably specified Taylor rules, we find they're telling us rates should be higher than they actually are. So one takeaway from this might be that if anything, I suspect the Fed will now take a wait and see approach, because, again, their output gap is largely positive. They're sort of where they want to be with respect to output, and inflation, though below 2%, is not terribly below 2%. So I would suspect that they would sort of hold steady unless additional data come in that suggests that they should reverse course.
How political, or how closely do investors watch the action from the Fed? Is it apolitical? Is it tied into an election cycle at all, and an economic policy of a president?
Yeah, it's an interesting question. Well, John Taylor was on President Trump's shortlist as appointee for chair of the Fed. So Jay Powell got the appointment, but John Taylor was on the shortlist. And I think there was certainly a message there to send that the notion that monetary policy should be more rules-based and less sort of discretion-based was heard loud and clear. Whether or not that was the intention by having John Taylor's name on the shortlist is nothing specific to John Taylor, but that was just an association that folks, I think, were making. So, what the Fed is doing on a tactical level sounds very technical and algorithmic, and it's all about just what the math is telling them to do and so on. The reality, of course, is quite different. And so they are an agency of the government. And while they are in some ways politically independent, there's no question, I would think, that the leaders of the Fed are at least mindful of the political winds and whether they shift and so forth. I'd like to think that current monetary policy is, again, largely speaking, apolitical, but we have to be realistic, and I don't doubt that the political environment in which the Fed operates could, on some level, shape some decisions. I'm not prepared to say which. I don't know, but I think I'd be naive to suggest otherwise.
It seems like every president would want the economy to look good and to be doing well. Yes. So
that's right. To be fair, there is no president that comes into office and says, please, I want you to raise interest rates, contract monetary policy and get me a recession. Right. That's usually not the line that's heard from the White House to the Fed in any case. That's right.
All right. So when we talk about Taylor and the algorithms and the increasing use of artificial intelligence and machine learning, like how much is that sort of playing into how people are learning about getting assistance, technological assistance, to these very human decisions?
Yeah, that's a really interesting question, because it feels really new, right? You think, well, this sort of algorithmically driven, this kind of a love of technology and rules over discretion. In macroeconomics and monetary policy, this debate is actually decades old. This notion that you could essentially use artificial intelligence to navigate monetary policy, we didn't call it AI, but that you can do this, is this argument for so-called rules over discretion. So it's an interesting question. The debate's actually been around for several decades in monetary and macro. Though, to your point, I think there is now an additional interest in the possibility that we could turn monetary policy over to some sort of computer code and with big data and sort of do just as good a job. I'll just say for the record, I don't share that view. And I really do think that sort of rational, apolitical, discretionary monetary policy of the sort that we see implemented as a result of, say, the Federal Open Market Committee is the better path to take. But you're right. There is this interest in a sort of an AI application to monetary policy.
Because not everyone on the committee agrees. They're having a conversation, and some people are voting against that cut.
Absolutely. It's a sort of a consensus-driven effort where at the end they say, you know, here's what we decided, and we, you know, a couple of folks, and here they are amicably resisted this decision or what have you.
Right.
But that's right. It's there are definitely dissenters, and we learn who they are at the end of each FOMC meeting. So, yeah, it can be messy in the way that human decision-making and discretion can be messy. That's true.
So what happens next then? Investors have confidence. Consumer spending is still going pretty well. Like what are the impacts of that in how people live their daily lives?
Yeah. So this decision to keep the Fed funds rate or to lower it and now perhaps keep it there unless new data suggests otherwise is consistent with the view the Fed has, and they've been quite open about this, that this is refer to it as a mid-cycle adjustment. And whether it's mid-cycle, that would suggest we have another 10 to go. I don't know, 10 years that is. But it's what they're calling a mid-cycle adjustment. And so their thinking is that this sort of change in rates will keep the expansion going. Expansion's been going for over 10 years. We'll have a segment on this very soon. And so that has direct consequences for our economic quality of life. Employment rates remain historically low. And so, we can think about what the Fed just did last week as something that they view as necessary to maintain this current strength in the economy. And you're right, consumer spending is strong. Labor markets remain tight. We see some increases in real wages, which is promising. It directly affects us if monetary theory is to be believed, because keeping these rates low keep the credit system lending, and that fuels economic growth.
You can find more at schooled.blog.com. We'll also put a link up to that on our website, listen.sdpb.org. Joe Santos is professor of economics and the Dykehouse Scholar of Money, Banking, and Regulation. He teaches at the Ness School of Management and Economics at SDSU, and he joined us from SDSU's Janine Basinger studio. Joe, thanks so much. We'll see you next Monday.
Thank you, Lori. Bye-bye.
We will take a break. When we come back, I should correct that, because next Monday is Veterans Day. So we'll have a 2-week break before we see Joe Santos again.